Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and this is episode 70, The Golden Age of Dinosaur Discovery, which Liz recorded with Dr. David Evans, who's Associate Professor at the University of Toronto and Curator at the Royal Ontario Museum. So, you're all probably be thinking, just when is the Golden Age of Dinosaur Discovery? And the easy answer to that is probably now, but the real question is, why is it now? And that's going to be the focus of this interview. But before we get into it, we just have the usual pieces of admin to get through first. Firstly, we've managed to get control of our website back after being hacked. So thanks to everyone who supported us during that time, and especially to all those who donated money. It really was appreciated. Secondly, the Virtual Natural History Museum is coming along really nicely, and the website architecture is now completed. We've even had the pleasure of being able to explore the, albeit empty, museum. The user interface is everything I ever could have hoped it would be, and just being able to run around with a group of your friends is entertaining enough in itself. So now the only thing we've left to do is to populate it with the world's paleontological multimedia, which shouldn't be too much of a big job, should it? And then finally, we've PaleoCast members attending SVP in Salt Lake City at the end of the month. So if you're going as an academic with a story to tell, or if you know of someone you want us to try and interview, just send us a message and we'll see what we're able to do. So we've long passed the golden age of lengthy PaleoCast introductions, so I'll just remind you to look at our website for the images to support this interview and to like and share it on social media. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Today I am actually in Toronto at the Royal Ontario Museum with David Evans, who's the curator of vertebrate paleontology. Thank you for sitting down with me today, David. Can you start by telling us a bit about yourself and how you got into paleontology and how you got to the ROM?
Well, I'm curator at the ROM here, and my specialty is dinosaurs, and I'm basically living my childhood dream. I actually saw dinosaurs for the first time when I was about 4 years old here at the Royal Ontario Museum, and like many kids, I was bit by the dinosaur bug, and I never looked back. My family lived about an hour and a half from Toronto towards Niagara Falls until I was about 10, and so my uncle brought me here when I was four, and I still remember the amazing duckbill dinosaur room here at the ROM, which is images are pretty famous around the world, and they had a great mosasaur exhibit that was quite moody, and it recreated an ancient sea, and and from that moment on, I knew I wanted to be a paleontologist, and as I grew up, I got inspired by people like Phil Curry and Dale Russell and Peter Dodson and these great paleontologists who are amazing researchers and contributed hugely to our understanding of these animals, but also were amazing at reaching out to the public. And I was just, I was a voracious reader of dinosaur books and dinosaur documentaries and so on. And I heard when I was a kid, I was a friend of the Trail Museum. I was 5 years old when it opened in 1985, and shortly thereafter, they started a couple of public programs where you could go and dig dinosaurs with Phil Curry and the team. And I basically waited until I was 18 and could sign up for one of these, go on a dinosaur dig to Dinosaur Park. And as soon as I turned 18, I took all the money that I'd saved up and I enrolled in the field experience program. And that summer, 1998, I met Phil Curry and I met Michael Ryan, who really took me under his wing.
Yeah.
And the next summer, I had a job at the Trail Museum, and I was a second year undergrad at the University of British Columbia at that point. Mm-hmm. No vertebrate paleontologist.
Yeah.
So I asked if I could do theses with them, and so Don and Michael and Dave Eberth and Phil.
Yeah.
gave me duckbill projects, and that's how I got into working on duckbills from Alberta. And then as I was doing my PhD, the job here came up, and I was in Toronto by that time working on the duckbills here. And I still pinch myself when I think about it. They hired me when I was 25, and I can't even imagine what they were thinking of. Basically hired a kid to be in charge of the dinosaur program here. But I think it's worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely lucky to think. I grew up in Alberta and just got to go to Dinosaur Provincial Park for the first time like 2 weeks ago. And you got to go when you were 18.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm very jealous.
Yeah, and the first quarry I ever worked in was a Diplodocus quarry. Which was pretty cool, my first day in Dinosaur Park. And then my second day, I was whisked away to southern Alberta to work in the Old Man Formation along the Milk River Ridge, and with Mike Orion digging up a new Ceratopsian. And that's really led into my field work today, which Michael and I have been working in southern Alberta for the last 12 years in a major project, which has been amazingly fun and successful. I think we've got 6 or 8 new dinosaurs in the last 5 years from that project, which is incredible.
Yeah. What kind of dinosaurs? Do they kind of span all dinosaurs or just ceratopsians or?
Yeah, we're focusing on that area of the Milk River because it has rocks that are older than the heavily prospected and sampled rocks of Dinosaur Provincial Park.
Okay.
And the even younger rocks. From around Drumheller.
Mm-hmm.
And they correspond to a time period of the Santonian and early to middle Campanian, about 85 to 75 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's not just poorly sampled in Alberta or in North America, but generally globally. And so, this was very directed. We thought that if we focused on these rocks, which hadn't been worked very much in the past, but had produced some fragmentary fossils, that if we just got boots on the ground and put some effort in, that we would find something that would fill in this sort of major gap temporally we have in the dinosaur record, and maybe help us to answer some questions about the origin of these sort of ceratopsian and duckbill tyrannosaur dominated faunas, which everybody knows today is sort of classic late Cretaceous faunas, but they all set themselves up in that early late Cretaceous window.
Okay.
And we've been finding some really neat primitive ceratopsids that have shed light on how that group attained its characteristic ornamentation of the skull and frill. We found the oldest dome-headed dinosaur, which has told us a lot about not just the evolution of that group, but preservation of small-bodied ornithischians in general. And we've also found some small-bodied ornithopods. No good theropods yet. but I'm hoping that we can find some new theropods. Actually, just last year we got a nice Diplodocus skeleton from a bit younger beds, which is awesome. Not a new species, but it's our first good theropod project.
Doesn't always have to be a new species.
No.
You can find cool new old things. So you've kind of mentioned before, which is what we wanted to talk about, was this golden age of dinosaur discovery. Can you explain a little bit what you mean by that and kind of what the background of that is?
I guess it was a couple of years ago. Somebody was asked in an interview. They said, we were doing an interview. I think it was about Xenoceratops, one of the new ceratopsians that we had found. And I had mentioned that, we actually have found a whole bunch of new dinosaurs, and we have many more that we have in the lab that are awaiting to get names.
Mm.
What people might not know is we're actually in sort of a second golden age of dinosaur discovery in Alberta.
Mm.
And I think that is certainly emblematic of what's going on worldwide in terms of finding new and exciting dinosaur fossils. And we are sort of tracking it by just numbers of species that we've discovered. In the last 10 years in Alberta, there's been over a dozen new dinosaurs that have been discovered. And if you look at that in graph form, numbers of species over the last 100 years, the rate at which we're discovering new species It's exponential now, and it hasn't been higher since the great Canadian dinosaur rush of the 1910s and 1920s. And it shows no signs of abating. Mm. And if you look globally, you see a very similar pattern. The last 10 to 15 years, the numbers of new dinosaur species that are being found is just off the charts. We find somewhere between 30 and 50 new species a year, on average, about one every 2 weeks. And there's no sign of that slowing down. And so, you know, if you're interested in dinosaurs, you couldn't be alive at a better time. We're making more discoveries than we ever have been at a rate that's virtually unparalleled since, you know, the classic classic paleontologists worked in the late 1800s and early 1900s.
Why is that? Why is it in the last 10 years that this has been happening so much? Is it just because more people are going out and looking, or technology, or what is kind of the reason behind it?
I think there are multiple reasons behind it. I think one of the major reasons is just simply political and economic. So a lot of the new discoveries that we're seeing are from places like South America and China. And they are investing in paleontology more than they ever have. And there are more paleontologists in those areas that can explore their backyards. And they've developed amazing homegrown paleontology programs that 50 years ago, they just weren't that numerous. And when you are on top of the fossils or close to the fossil bearing rocks, you know, you find more stuff. But I think it's more than that. I think the public interest in dinosaurs has a lot to do with the current golden age that we're in. And I think that probably owes its roots to Jurassic Park, probably. There's I'm sure a Jurassic Park effect to this. That ever since, you know, 1993, when the first movie came out, the public interest in dinosaurs just shot up hugely. And it hasn't looked back. And I think that's over the last, 20 years or so. It's taken a while to sort of get hold, but that, I think, huge public appetite for dinosaurs has resulted in more positions at universities and at museums for dinosaur workers specifically. And there's a whole new generation of young dinosaur workers that have been hired in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
I'm one of them. I was sort of, I think, maybe one of the earlier ones that was hired, but there's a lot of new, great young researchers who are getting positions who are trying to not only establish themselves, but also have this appetite for exploration and thirst for knowledge to fill in these gaps. And they're going to places that have been poorly explored, and we're able to get to places that have never been explored. And as a result, we're having more discoveries made. So we have more people who are aware of the gaps that we have in the fossil record and going directly to rocks to sample them. And I think that's also resulting in a lot of these new discoveries.
I mean, I just thinking from a personal level, I was 6 when Jurassic Park came out. And at the time, you know, I wasn't a big fan. And actually, I wasn't a big dinosaur crazy kid at all. But looking back on it, you know, there's so many people my age that are going into paleo and want to be, you know, professors and stuff. And they all say, well, I grew up watching Jurassic Park.
Yep. I can think of probably 10 people right now who say that one of their big influences was Jurassic Park. And I was bit by the bug before Jurassic Park. So it wasn't a real big influence on me. But even a lot of my graduate students, for sure, who are only 5 years behind me, Jurassic Park was a big deal. For them. And, you know, I'm okay with that. I mean, it portrayed dinosaurs in a way that was the most scientifically accurate representation of them that had ever been done. Some of it was provocative. Some of it pushed the envelope a little bit. But it really brought them to life. You know, an interesting, you asked about technology as being potentially related to this. And, you know, one of the one of the talks that I often give is how to dig up a dinosaur. And I start with that scene in Jurassic Park where they're using the ground penetrating radar. And, you know, pretty soon we're not going to have to dig anymore. And Grant goes, what's the fun in that? And I couldn't agree more. But, you know, that is, technology has really not played a huge role, I would argue, in the increasing rate of discoveries. I mean, how often do we use ground penetrating radar now? Almost never. I mean, never.
No.
Probably less than was used in the immediate aftermath of Jurassic Park. And, you know, when we're in the field, we, you know, I think it's just getting, I think where technology has played a role is just accessibility into areas like the Gobi Desert or like the Arctic. These places are getting much more accessible than they were even 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, getting to the rocks is one of the most fundamental parts of finding fossils.
Yeah.
You know, some of the work I do is in Sudan, and there's obviously some political barriers there. But it's getting easier and easier to get into the Sahara, for instance, or into the Gobi. It's amazingly easy to get into the Gobi. and I've done some work there. And I think that has played a role. I mean, 25 years ago, it was really hard to get to the Arctic. And now, you know, I guess climate change is our friend in some ways. The field season is lengthening, but it's becoming much easier to get to those places.
So in terms of actual new species discoveries, maybe technology doesn't play a big role, but it does kind of increase what we can do with the fossils. So is it also showing an increase in just general large-scale studies, or is it just in terms of discovering a new species for this golden age, I guess?
No, I think that the age of discovery that we're in now is certainly hugely promoted and facilitated by new technologies to analyze the material big time. If we're sort of tracking it as number of species as a proxy, we can talk about that. But if we're talking about just the amount of research that's coming out, I think new technology is playing a huge role in our understanding everything from being able to 3D model, CT scan, 3D model, endocasts or skulls to to find an element analysis and so on. I mean, these have played a huge role in understanding the biology of the animals.
Do you think that there's a general increase in the number of big papers coming out as well, or is just discovery in species?
Well, I think the number of papers coming out is massive.
Yeah.
It's really hard to keep up these days.
Yeah, it is.
And there's so many students now too. I mean, the number of, you know, the number of new professors and curators that have been hired, of course, that cascades down and they all have students and labs and so on. And, you know, those graduate students are doing such amazing work now, cutting edge work, and any one PI has multiple graduate students. And so when you sort of put all that together, the amount of science that's being done, whether, in paleontology or in other sciences, is just, it's massive.
Yeah. Thinking about the Jurassic Park effect, of course, the main thing is dinosaurs, and you mainly work on dinosaurs, but do you think it's affected the number of things being discovered, like new species of pterosaurs or mosasaurs or marine reptiles or anything like that as well?
I would say absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, my motivation of going to Northern Sudan, which is a cool project I've been involved in over the last 5 years with colleagues in Berlin and Sudan, was to, my main interest was going there to find dinosaurs from the late Cretaceous in Africa.
Yeah.
Which are extremely rare, and we found some fragmentary dinosaurs, but we found tons of crocodilians and turtles that are new to science, and so we've actually been concentrating on writing those up. There's some right here on the desk, it's dragged me into working on crocodiles, so I think that whenever I go out and do field work, and I think this is the case with all of us, is that we don't just collect the taxon that we're interested in. We pick everything up that might be of interest. And as far as dinosaurs, it might be collateral damage or whatever, but we're finding all sorts of cool stuff. In fact, in Alberta, we I remember Wendy Sloboda was just amazing at finding fossils. She thought she had found a caimanathid, an Oviraptorosaur, and she had it in her hands, and she thought I was going to be really excited. And she's like, I've got something, you're going to love this. She put it into my hands, and I looked at it, and I was like, oh, a turtle? And she goes, oh, damn, I thought that was an overafter. And it turned out to be a brand new genus and species of sea turtle that Dawn Brinkman named after her again. But, yeah, I mean, it's a good example of how just being out there, you know, you don't just find, you know, you don't just find one thing, you find the whole fauna. And it's, I think it's just as important to understand everything that lived with the dinosaurs as it did the dinosaurs themselves.
Sure. Because
you have to understand them in an ecological context.
Sure. You know, we've talked a little bit about your work in Alberta and now a little bit in Sudan as well. Are there other places around the world you've been able to work stemming from this kind of new, exciting, getting money to go and do field work?
Yeah, I'd say the one that certainly is tied to this idea most closely is I've done some work in the Canadian Arctic. And that's benefited from government funding through the Polar Continental Shelf Project.
Cool.
Which provides logistical support for getting up there.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is some political reasons why more money is going towards Arctic exploration, as you know, as well as scientific ones. You know, there's a sovereignty question with Canada and the U.S. and Russia and the northern Northwest Passage and so on, and it's actually benefited scientists because the Canadian government, among all sorts of other mandates, wants to get more people up there.
Yeah,
and we've got a number of grants to go up to the Arctic to look for fossils. And with climate change, there is less ice up there for longer periods of time. And the field season, which was once really short, is in the last 30 years has gotten much longer. And those areas, of course, in the Canadian Arctic specifically, have lots of Mesozoic aged rock that is almost certainly filled with great fossils. There's a lot of marine sediment up there, so plesiosaurs and but there's also some marginal marine and some terrestrial stuff, and we found some cool stuff in the Yukon and the Northwest Territories and on my expeditions.
What kind of material have you been finding from there?
Mostly fragmentary stuff.
Yeah.
And to be honest, it's been a bit frustrating. I was hoping to go to the northern Yukon and Northwest Territories and find basically North Slope Alaska type deposits, which are incredibly rich in, in dinosaurs, big bone beds of duckbills and horned dinosaurs from a really interesting time period, right close to the KT boundary. And we found bits and pieces. And I worked with Hans Larsen up on Bylot Island for a year and bits and pieces again. And at some point, someone is going to be up there and just going to blow the lid off of it. And find a, you know, great skeletons. But actually, I've just because of how intense the logistics are, I haven't gone back for a few years because it's sort of an investment versus return.
Sure.
And Alberta has been returning like crazy. And so is the Sudan, and it just has sort of fallen off. But there's tremendous potential up there, tremendous potential.
I have a friend who does field work on Svalbard, and she does a lot of work on marine reptiles from there. And they only get like 2 weeks of field season per year. So it surprises me that the Arctic is having more than that, because I would expect it to be similar to Svalbard, but I don't know if it's just not as far north as Svalbard or what it is, because they only go out for 2 weeks a year.
Yeah, I don't know what the local conditions are, but you certainly can get a good month up in the Arctic Islands. Wow. If, you know, and I don't even think you have to be necessarily that lucky to do that anymore. I've certainly spent a month up up there, and we got a reasonably decent field season, so...
That's impressive. Just going back to kind of Alberta and other things that you've been up to, you, in the last couple of years, did a bit of a TV show related to some stuff down in Alberta with Dino Hunt Canada. Can you tell me a little bit about that and how that kind of came to be and what it was?
Yeah, Dino Hunt Canada is a really fun project. And it was, its genesis was... basically a coffee conversation with a producer, as many of these things are. And we had just done a very successful dinosaur exhibition here called Ultimate Dinosaurs, which we're very proud of. We is a homegrown exhibition, and it explored why the southern dinosaurs that are being found in places like Patagonia and Africa and Madagascar are just so wildly different from the T-Rex and Triceratops we're familiar with. And it sort of talked about vicariant evolution and the breakup of Pangaea and how, you know, life on Earth is intimately related to the evolution of the Earth itself. Mm-hmm. And History Channel approached a couple of production companies and said that they'd be interested in doing a series on dinosaurs and to talk to us. And they were interested in doing something with Ultimate Dinosaurs, I think. And and I said, well, I mean, this is all cool, but you wouldn't believe the amazing discoveries that are being made right here in Canada. And, you know, there are 6 or 8 field teams that go out specifically to look for dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And a lot of the principal investigators are young people like me, and they're exploring areas that have been poorly explored, and they're finding all sorts of cool things. Mm-hmm. And it would be a really neat idea to do a documentary that was sort of like a day in the life of a field paleontologist in Canada, but more of like a field season in the life of, so they could visit not only our camp on the Milk River, but they could visit, you know, Phil Curry in Dinosaur Park, and they could visit Hans Larsen in Saskatchewan, and Rich McRae and Lisa Buckley in BC, and Tim Fedek in Nova Scotia. And you could sort of start in the early Jurassic, and you could kind of work your way, you know, you skip some time, but go through the late Cretaceous right up to the KT boundary. And they were surprised to hear that, you know, that all these new species were being discovered. And I offered they could come up and watch us dig up a new species of horned dinosaur, which ultimately turned out to be Wendiceratops. And they said, okay, well, we'll pitch that to history and see what they say. And I didn't really have much hope for it. And so I was blown away when they came back and they said, yeah, well, we decided not to do one documentary, but they wanted to do 4. And I was like, wow, this is awesome. You know, what a great way to showcase, you know, all the great talent and that we have in Canada, and all the amazing fossil beds, and to tie it to this, you know, really deep history that we have in terms of paleontology, but also in terms of the paleontologists. So each episode, they did 4 episodes, and they took, they basically split it. So each episode had 2 teams.
Okay.
And did exactly that. They started in, or well, they actually didn't start in Nova Scotia. They started with us in the Milk River, but ultimately it covered from the early Jurassic right up to the extinction of the dinosaurs. And it turned out, I think, turned out pretty well.
Yeah.
Getting back to sort of those old time documentaries of watching scientists work and explain how we know what we know, rather than the walking with dinosaurs style.
Did they do 8 different teams then? So 2 different teams per episode?
Yeah, they did that, but Phil got Phil got 2. He got a 2-fer,
of course,
which makes sense. And they did that, and then once it started to take shape, history got pretty excited about what they were getting, and we applied for a big grant to do a companion website and to do an exhibit, and so that was exciting. On the website, we highlighted the highlight dinosaurs in the series. That came up, and so there's sort of a dinosaur dictionary of some of the big Canadian dinosaurs. And then we also, though, took people from the field into the lab and took them through the process of actually preparing a fossil and getting it ready for display.
Yeah.
And then we opened the display at the museum. And so I think one of the most innovative things that we did as part of that project is that we did a live stream of the preparators preparing the new species. So you could actually look through oculars of a microscope and over the shoulder of a technician cleaning a bone and revealing its surface that, you know, no one had ever seen before. And you could do that in real time.
Yeah.
And that was pretty cool for me, wherever I was in the world. I could always check on whether my technicians were working, which was also cool. So it was great. And ultimately, we were nominated for a Canadian Screen Award, which is like the Canadian Emmys for it. And because I was they called me a producer, or no, wait a minute, a developer. And anyways, this was crazy. I never, ever in a million years thought I would be nominated for a TV award. But it was nominated for Best Cross-Platform Production. Yeah. And so doing TV, web, and an exhibit is something that was quite novel. We didn't win, but it was pretty neat to be nominated for something like that.
Yeah, not something you normally think of for a paleontologist to
get there. Yeah, I certainly didn't expect it.
The new species that you talked about in the show and then eventually turned into that new exhibit is Wendiceratops. Can you talk a little bit about that discovery and a bit about that really awesome specimen?
Yeah, Wendiceratops has definitely been one of the highlight discoveries of my career. It was really cool to be a part of it. Of course, I didn't make it myself. that the initial fossils were discovered by Wendy Sloboda. Mm-hmm. And she's a legendary fossil hunter in Alberta. She found her first fossils when she was a teenager. And her first big discovery was the Devil's Coulee nesting site, which included the first eggs with embryos in it in them in North America.
Wow.
And she discovered those when I think she was 16.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty wild.
Yeah.
And she went on to work for the Trail Museum, and she moved on from there. But she's a homegrown talent. She lives in a small farming town in southern Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with her when I worked at the Trail Museum when I was a student. And of course, Michael's worked with her, Michael Ryan, for a while. And she's been joining us in the field every year of our Southern Alberta Dinosaur Project for the last 12 years. And we joke that we're Wendy's cleanup crew because she runs around the Badlands, and she just has the sixth sense for finding important specimens. And so we basically, Wendy finds the stuff and we dig it up, and we don't complain because she always finds amazing stuff. And that's the way the Wendiceratops story started. Is she was out prospecting, and she found a couple of pieces of skull of Ceratopsian. And she brought them to Michael and I, and we both knew instantly. We're like, whoa, this is really neat. You could see some of the ornamentation on the frill, and it was kind of curving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, oh, that's really weird. And we asked her where she found it, and she found it basically, you know, right on top of the foremost formation, right in the very bottom of the Old Man formation. And that's when the light bulbs went off, and we got really excited because we knew that would be some of the oldest ceratopsid from that family material ever found. And we knew that we suspected, based on what she had already found, that it was probably something new. And so Wendy took us to the site, and it was a low-density bone bed. And it was relatively easy digging, preserved in a mudstone. But it was at the base of this hill that was, like, vertical and 100 feet tall.
Oh.
And we had to spend well over a full field season jackhammering this hill. It's the biggest quarry that I've ever been involved with. And it was a risk, but it really paid off. We collected over 200 bones from this bone bed. We got about 50% of the skeleton, including a lot of the important parts of the skull. We got an almost complete frill of multiple ontogenic stages. And we also got, what was really exciting, we also got part of the nose horn, a good chunk of it. And enough to say that it had a tall, erect nose horn.
Mm.
And this is pretty characteristic of ceratopsians. When we think of ceratopsians, we think of, you know, Centrosaurus, or Triceratops, or, you know, Styracosaurus, whatever, has these big nose horns.
Yeah.
But it turns out that this specimen from Wendy Ceratops is the oldest record of a nose horn, a proper nose horn in the family. And when you put it together with some other new discoveries, a lot of the primitive centrosaurs, which are these short frilled horn dinosaurs that Wendy Ceratops is part of, they actually don't have nose horns. And it was interesting because when you actually put it together, it looks like the nose horn in horn dinosaurs evolved twice. Once in chasmosaurines, which include triceratops, and then once in the short frilled centrosaurs. And so they got their nose horns by convergent evolution. And it told us something about how horn dinosaurs acquired their characteristic horn dinosaur faces, ceratops, horn dinosaur, horn face, that we really didn't know before. And it gave us a mark in the road as to when, at least minimally, that that feature evolved in that lineage. So it painted an interesting picture about the evolution of ornamentation in the group. It also has this wicked frill with these big droopy hooks that adorn the entire margin. And when we got all this prepped out, we were, of course, really excited. And we had to name it something totally different from anything anyone had seen before. And we played around with names, but Wendy is just such a force of nature. And she's found so many things in her career, over 3,000 specimens at the Terrell Museum alone. But she never had a dinosaur named after her.
Yeah.
So we just had to.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, Wendy is, she's quite the character. She's completely covered in tattoos. She has dreadlocks. And after the paper came out, the name was official. Next time I saw Wendy, she jumps out of the truck and she has this giant tattoo on her forearm of the reconstruction of Wendy Ceratops by Danielle Dufault. He's an amazing paleo artist. And she gave me a big hug and she shows off the tattoo. She's like, I've been waiting. This has been for my dinosaur. And finally we were able to get Wendy a tattoo of her dinosaur.
Did she know about it before you named it, or did she find out when everyone else did?
No, right before we were sort of deciding the name, and Wendy Ceratops is actually kind of a placeholder name. It sort of started as, oh, we'll call it Wendy Ceratops. And we tried to think of something better and honor her, you know, maybe in the specific epithet. It just sort of grew on us. And, you know, a dinosaur is known by its genus name. And so we thought, you know, this is the best way to give Wendy her props. And so the week before we submitted the paper, said, hey, would you be comfortable with this? And she was, of course, thrilled.
Yeah.
But I didn't ever, you know, I didn't think that she would basically get a tattoo right away.
Obviously, the Southern Alberta Dinosaur Project has been quite successful for you guys. Is it something that you're planning on continuing for a while? Do you still have lots of money for it, or are you kind of planning on finishing it up anytime soon?
We are doing really well.
Yeah.
And we have no plans of stopping anytime soon. Getting money is something we do year to year.
Okay.
So we apply for all of our money each year. But so far, so good. We've been lucky enough to cobble together enough funds to do it. It's not horribly expensive.
No.
And we actually had our very best year of our 12 years last year.
Okay.
And so we have so much to do.
Yeah.
We just keep building up the database of sites that we have to excavate. But last year we found this Diplodocus skeleton. We found a beautiful Lambeosaur, completely articulated.
Wow.
First one from the Old Man Formation.
Wow.
We found a new species of Kritosaur-like Hadrosaur, an associated skeleton. And we are digging up another new horned dinosaur bone bed. All of these found by Wendy.
Wow.
Of course. Jeez. And then the last day of the season, Wendy found a completely three-dimensionally preserved mummified duckbill.
Wow.
Which is totally jaw-dropping. Amazing. Skin just completely covering the skeleton.
Wow.
It was eroded out in blocks from a sandstone concretion. But we think we have the skull, and we have just phenomenal skin impressions from the whole thing. Hmm. So we were really excited to get back into the field, and we're headed there in 2 weeks.
Okay.
And to continue working on all these things. We started all the quarries last year.
Yeah.
And we're just excited to get back.
Yeah.
We also found 2 new pachycephalosaur species. And, oh yeah, the first articulated Santonian-aged dinosaur from the Milk River Formation, which is a
wow. Duck bill.
Yeah, it's almost embarrassing to say how good we did. And almost all of them were found by Wendy Sloboda.
Wow. So when you go out there, how long is the field season typically?
Our field seasons are typically 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay.
And we typically run crew about 15 to 20 people.
Okay.
And so we'll work 3 quarries and usually have like a prospecting sort of geology team.
Yeah.
Run section and looks for stuff. Wendy will never sit in a quarry, and that is not the best use of Wendy's time. So there's usually a prospecting crew with Wendy or a geology crew, and then there's the quarries.
Is it the same 15 people for the whole time, or do you rotate out?
No, we cycle out quite
a
bit.
Yeah.
We cycle out quite a bit, and Michael and I have a number of students at different levels that we cycle through. And we often have visitors, like Phil Curry comes down.
Yeah.
He's quite excited to work on the Displetosaur, so he's visiting us for a week, and he'll bring a few of his students. And we have a good core group of volunteers that join us in the field as well.
Yeah.
So we like to get them in. So it's always busy and exciting, and always cool stuff is being found, and that's my favorite place.
Yeah. So if the Southern Alberta Dinosaur Project is doing really well, do you think that this kind of prime dinosaur discovery age is going to continue for a while, or is it something that's kind of wrapping up or at risk of slowing down anytime soon?
I haven't ran the numbers. I've ran the numbers in Canada.
Yeah.
And I know what's on the horizon in Canada. And, if numbers of species discovered is a good proxy for just overall research output. We're in this exponential phase right now, and there's no sign of it slowing down in Canada, and I don't think there's any sign of it slowing down globally. I think that we're going to continue this really rapid pace of discovery for probably a decade or so to come, at least.
Good news for people looking for jobs.
Yeah. Absolutely.
No, that's really great. I mean, I knew that there were lots of species coming out, of course, but I didn't realize really how many and how many of them were coming out from Canada, too.
So. Yeah. I mean, people are surprised of that number in Canada, because if there's any place you think that has been prospected out or played out in terms of the dinosaur beds,
sure.
I mean, you might think Alberta. I mean, there's been multiple crews every year for the last 100 years that have worked there. But it turns out that they've focused, if you look at sort of the historical arc, a lot of those crews have gone to the same places, Dinosaur Provincial Park or Drumheller, over and over again.
Yeah.
They've made discoveries elsewhere, but because the riches of Dinosaur Park are just so incredible, they've sort of, it's kind of like a magnet or something.
Yeah.
They're drawn to, collecting the 50th articulated specimen of Carithosaurus, which is cool. But, it takes a lot more work to come up with something that, a discovery in those areas that's really significant, because you just have so much effort that's come before you. But if you step outside of those really intensely prospected bubbles, the Hell Creek Formation in the Western Interior U.S. is another example. If you step outside of those and maybe go to the places that are harder to get to, and maybe the fossils appear to be more fragmentary, that's where you can make some pretty interesting discoveries. I mean, a good example is the Kapirowitz Formation and the Waweep in Utah, where, that was some pretty inaccessible, hard to get to, hard to work outcrop. And it's really been in the last 15 years, with Scott Sampson and his crews, and that's now carried on to that the next generation. The discoveries coming out of there are just phenomenal.
Yeah.
And we've known about the Kapirowitz beds for a century. But people just haven't really worked them.
Yeah.
And sometimes it just takes, working a little bit harder and putting a little bit more effort into some of these places that haven't historically been worked, but they'll produce good stuff. Madagascar is another really good example. We knew about the fossils in the Monero formation in Madagascar for a long time.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until people figured out how to collect the fossils with Dave Crowes that it just started to produce all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I think there's still lots of formations and lots of localities out there like that. Another great example is Ukko Tolgod. I mean, people work Mongolia, Lake Cretaceous Mongolia, for a really long time. And the AMNH just stumbled across this. I mean, it's a really small area of outcrop that just produced all this crazy stuff.
Hmm.
And there's got to be hundreds of Ukko Tolgods out there in the world that are still left to discover.
Well, that's great. Thank you for joining me, David, and good luck on your field season, I guess, in 2 weeks.
Thanks a lot, Liz. This has been great.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed @PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.